Joe R. Lansdale writes a broad spectrum of fiction, from a noir mystery series featuring two characters named Hap and Leonard, to fantasy and horror short fiction, Western novels, and short stories, as well as various genre mashups. In this interview, conducted in the KPFA studios on August 2, 1994, as part of the Probability series, he talks about his career and his most recent work at the time, which included his then-latest Hap and Leonard mystery novel, Mucho Mojo, and his work in comic books. My co-host was the late Richard A. Lupoff. This is the first of two interviews, then and now. Speaking of which, today there are at least 27 books in the Hap and Leonard series. The newest one is Hatchet Girls, plus 40 non-series novels and over 40 collections. A Hap and Leonard TV series starring James Purefoy and Michael K. Williams ran for 3 seasons on AMC Plus starting in 2016.
Joe, you bounce around genres, don't you?
I sort of write whatever interests me. I just kind of move with the wind, so to speak. And I don't really think of myself as being any one type of writer. I seem to be in the suspense mode here lately. I'm really enjoying that. As long as I feel comfortable doing it, I do it.
The Savage Season was the prequel.
That's right, to be followed by the Two Bear Mambo after Mucho Mojo.
When you wrote Savage Season, did you think that you'd be writing a series?
Nope, had no idea. I wrote Savage Season, and it was sometime later, and I sat down to write a new novel, and this character, the main character in Savage Season, Hap Collins, he started talking to me again, and he started coming out, and I couldn't get rid of him, and I wrote about 50 pages of it, put it aside, wrote another novel I was unhappy with, went back and wrote this one, and realized that, hey, as long as they want to speak to me, I'll let them.
Most of your books take place in Texas, is this correct?
That's right. East Texas, primarily.
Which is where you're from.
Which is where I'm from. Which is very different than people's general perception of Texas. It's very wooded, you know, very creeks, rivers. It's not a dusty plain or whatever. It's more southern than it is southwestern.
And this is the area just next to Louisiana?
Yeah, close to Louisiana, right.
Well, what are the towns in there?
Well, Nacogdoches is not really near. I guess the biggest town is Tyler. And that probably doesn't ring a bell with you either.
Oh, it rings an important bell with me.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
3 hours from Houston, 3.5 hours or 4 hours from Dallas. That's the best way I know how to tell you.
And Mucho Mojo is very much I wouldn't call it a Texas novel so much as a Southern novel, because it seems that the attitudes of the people are very Southern.
That's right. They're not. That's what I'm saying. That's why it's very different. Most people think of Southwest. Even people read the book, and I've described the countryside or talk to them about it, they still insist on seeing it with buttes and dust and wind, and it's not like that. But yes, very Southern. Southern culture permeates East Texas. It also has some of the Cajun culture, some of the Mexican influence, and then some of the Southwestern.
Mucho Mojo deals with two characters, one black and gay, the other white and straight. How did that come to be?
That's one of those questions that's kind of hard for me to answer. I have friends that are both straight and gay, and it just so happened that when I started writing this, I had no idea that Leonard was gay in Savage Season until at some point he said something that made me realize that, and it was just there. I'm sure somehow the subconscious worked it out. I'd like to give you a really good pat answer, you know, but I really can't on that one.
How about the discussion? There's a discussion between Leonard and a fundamentalist preacher. Was that discussion something that had been going on in your head for some time?
Yes, I've had that discussion. I've had very similar discussion. A lot of the discussions in these books are things that have happened to me. A lot of the events are things that have happened to me. In Savage Season, for instance, I was a Vietnam War resistor, and I refused to go. Fortunately for me, unlike Hap, I didn't have to go to prison, but that's a long story.
So there's an underlying political element here as well.
I think there is, yeah. I try not to beat people over the head with it, but I think that for me to write something, there has to be some sort of thematic element, whether it's about racism or political. I'm not real political, but I think that there are elements of that, yes.
Rich, you mentioned the fact that the two best friends in this book, Hap Collins and Leonard Pines, excuse me, one of them is Collins is straight, Pines is gay. Neither of them is married or in a permanent relationship when the book begins. As the book goes along, Collins gets into a very, very steamy and exciting relationship with a female lawyer, as I recall. Mm-hmm. Whereas Leonard lives a totally celibate life. Is there a reason behind that?
I think in this particular novel that is, in the new one that isn't true, in the Two Bear Mambo. It's just that different emphasis for different characters at different times. They have different stages in their life when mm-hmm. things are happening for them. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of let it unfold. And in this, that's what unfolded. And I also felt, too, that the story here was really the friendship between these two guys and how they dealt with this horrible event in Leonard's life, not only the death of his uncle, but the fact that there are certain things associated with his uncle's death that don't look too good.
I don't think it's giving away any great secrets to say that there is a serious theme of child molestation in this book. And I was thinking recently that mystery writers in particular seem to move in waves.
That's true.
There's a sort of a crime du jour, mm-hmm. or it's more of a crime de decade.
I agree with you.
Right? Whether it was drug running at one time or terrorism at one time, mm-hmm. General gangster, mafia type at mm-hmm. another. Why is child molestation the crime de decade for mystery writers?
I think the awareness of that type of crime has grown tremendously. A friend of mine, Andrew Vax, I think has a lot to do with that. And I believe that he has pointed out that this is a more far-ranging crime than we expect and that it happens a lot more frequently than we like to believe. He's a real advocate, of course, for children, abused children, as a lawyer. And he's also a writer, writes novels.
He's been on this show.
Yeah,
we know him well. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. He's not ambiguous about what he believes.
Or about anything.
Yes, about anything. That's right. And I really love and respect Andrew. And so Andrew and I being friends, of course, I think probably makes me a little bit more aware of it. And having children myself makes me aware of it. And so I think that and the general atmosphere of the time all came together to make that sort of the background, though I really did keep it in the background purposely.
Yes, but to me also as a father and as a grandfather, this is a cause for great concern.
Oh, you bet.
It's odd. Just before I came down to the studio today while I was having my peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch, I turned on a little bit of CNN, and there was a truly horrendous report from Trenton, New Jersey today about a 7-year-old child who'd been strangled. And it turns out that the suspect, daven before the FCC and its rules, the obvious suspect in the case who has been arrested, has at least two prior convictions for this and was living in a sort of commune of ex-convicts, all of whom had gone up for the same crime and had formed a kind of club when they got out, and no one in the neighborhood had been notified.
Yeah, well, that's terrible. That's one of the things that I'm hoping that it's going to be changed by this new bill that people are calling the Oprah Winfrey bill, you know, that Andrew Vax was involved with. We're used to, if someone committed some sort of sex crime and they say they did it in Texas, that they could then go to Oklahoma and become a Girl Scout leader or a Boy Scout leader or whatever. Well, now that it's computerized now, that this follows them around. Used to, it didn't, and it led to more and more of these offenses. It wasn't like a one-time thing. Once these things got started, they continued. It's like throwing, you know, fuel on the fire.
Without going into detail again, what happened today, Dick, has elements in your book as well.
Yes.
Have you found in your research that they do hang together? People hang together?
Yes. Certainly, I think that what's the old birds of the feather, you know? I think that that's very true, yes.
You have a reputation for dealing with things that are kind of on the dark side.
Yes.
Bringing up from the unconscious. Has this gone on since you began writing, you think?
You know, when I first started out, what I wanted to do was just write Edgar Rice Burroughs pastiches. I think that's probably true of a lot of us that started out in science fiction and fantasy. And at some point, when I was in my early 20s, I had read detective fiction before that. I mean, Mickey Spillane. I discovered I read a book by Keith Lawmer called Fat Chance or something, and he mentioned it was a pastiche of Raymond Chandler's book. So I began to read Raymond Chandler's books. And there was something there that clicked. And I think it wasn't just that it was mystery or that it was dark, but it really clicked with the world that I think I grew up around. I suddenly felt like that I had come home in one sense, in the positive sense, and in a negative sense, I think I was just part of maturity as becoming an adult and realizing that it isn't all just, sense of wonder, that there's a certain darkness out there. And I began to deal with it through the writing, and I found myself drawn more and more towards crime fiction and towards dark fiction, whether it be horror or however I express that, but that sort of fiction.
There also seems to be a trend in Southern writers toward the dark and the gothic.
That's definitely true. I think it's built in. I'm not exactly sure why that is. I mean, I've heard all sorts of things. I relate to Flannery O'Connor very quick. I read that and I say, yeah, I know what she's talking about. And I read Faulkner. I know what, he's talking about. But I think the darkness is everywhere. But I think Southerners have a special way of looking at it. I don't think the Southerners have the monopoly on darkness, but I think they have a special way of looking at it.
Well, what do you think is the difference between, say, Southern darkness and, say, the darkness of someone like Stephen King?
New England darkness.
Yeah, New England darkness.
Eldritch horror.
Eldritch horror. it seems to me that Southern darkness is grittier and that it's mossier. I think the terrain has to do with a lot of how the feel that comes through in the work. I really do. I don't know how to explain that, but I do believe that the environment affects how you view things. Like East Texas is so wooded. It's a dark area. It's a mysterious area. You get down in the bottom lands and you're out there. And that's all there is to it. You just have a feeling of being on your own. And I think those things affect the soul of a writer or an artist or whatever, what type of things that you're doing, what type of work that you're doing. I think it's reflected.
Dick Lupoff.
There's been a movement or series of movements in popular genre literature in the past decade or so. Over in the science fiction universe, we had a brief fad now disappeared, and I don't hear anybody shedding tears over its departure, called cyberpunk.
Oh, yeah.
Which was adapted by some folks and modified into something called splatterpunk. Of which Joe Lansdale, I believe, was an advocate.
No, I was not.
You were not. You were not. Okay.
I never liked that term at all. I hated it. The problem with me was that I think that some of the material that I wrote could fit within that for that, a story, a novel, because I don't restrict myself. I don't want to be part of any movement. I've always been part of the Joe Lansdale movement. And also, I was doing what they came to be known for years before it was being done, before Clive Barker, before that. I mean, it's better. I'm just saying that it was there. And I don't say that in any way to pat myself on the back, but I'm really saying that I wasn't part of a movement because I was already doing it. And the only movement I was part of was mine. And if you go from the drive-in or Act of Love to Mucho Mojo to the Magic Wagon, you're going to have a hard time putting any one of those in any one box. You might find a voice that reverberates throughout, but you're not going to find the same tone or attitude.
Well, part of that voice is a penchant for a certain shocking imagery. Let me quote here. I believe this is the very first image summoned up in your new book, Mucho Mojo. It starts on the bottom of page one and continues back to page two, where we're talking about the hot sun as it affects a field worker in East Texas. We say, you keep your back bent and you keep on poking right on down that dusty row, hoping eventually it'll play out, though it never seems to. And of course, that East Texas sun, which by 10:30 a.m. is like an infected blister leaking molten pus, doesn't help matters. Well, I must say that infected blister leaking molten pus certainly stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah. Well, now there's no doubt that the imagery and the stuff is darkness. I guess more what I'm or graphic in to some extent. I guess more what I don't like is splatterpunk seems to imply a sort of axe in the head fiction. Mm-hmm. Where brains and guts and dismemberments are the main point of the fiction, and that's not my interest. But yes, there's no doubt that it's. If you consider that a graphic description, I guess so. It's using some pretty nasty imagery, sure.
Yes. Well, I'm wondering, as novelist to novelist, mm-hmm. as well as interviewer to guest, mm-hmm. if there is an aesthetic behind that, a literary theory, or if you just go with what feels right
to you.
It's
a little of both. It's a little of both.
Would you elaborate on that?
Well, it's hard for me to voice it because I try not to analyze myself and do too much to it. I'm afraid I might wreck something in there. But I'm certainly aware of what's gone before. You know, I believe that you can't go ahead if you don't know what's gone before. And people that want to be innovative that have only read the stuff that's been written in the last 2 years, I don't believe can be innovative. I guess in some ways I see myself as a subconscious innovator, at least in the way that I want to bring what's inside me out. I think, too, that growing up, that a lot of the people that I grew up with express themselves that way. So I'm merely using the language there, of the area where I came from. Metaphors and similes were used a lot, I think, as part of the culture, because at one point in time, I don't think people were that literate way back in the past. And so they used these very colorful metaphors and similes to describe things so that the imagery was clear. And then I think it just stayed there as time went on and people did become better educated and stuff. That just became a tradition of Texas. East Texas uses a lot of imagery of that nature. I mean, that's the way they talk.
Aaron Elkins recently mentioned to us that he thinks that the next big thing in mystery fiction is going to be regionalism. So, again, you're ahead of the time.
Well,
you're ahead
of
the pack.
I hope that's true. I always feel like I'm either behind or ahead too soon, you know.
You mentioned a little while ago several of your precursors, people mm-hmm. like Edgar Rice Burroughs, Keith Laumer, and mm-hmm. Raymond Chandler. Strikes me as a rather odd trio. Again, do you want to add any names to that list?
Oh, guys, you'd be here all day. I mean, you know, I like Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Faulkner. And then growing up in science fiction, and, you know, I read everybody, Ray Bradbury, Richard Matheson, and Robert Bloch, was not science fiction particularly, but that whole crowd, William F. Nolan, all of these people. And I think that it all just sort of ran together and made a little bit of a gumbo in my head, you know, and that's what I came up with. And it went through the Lansdale strainer in the East Texas background, and that's what came out, you know, electric gumbo.
All right, Richard Walensky.
You also work with comic books.
Yeah.
Rather curious comic books, Western comic books.
I love Westerns. Yeah.
Jonah Hex, and you've just started working on a series called The Lone Ranger, which in this series I understand The Lone Ranger and Tonto have a falling out.
Yeah, and I don't hurt anything by saying that the very first panel starts with Tonto slugging the Lone Ranger, and that's where it begins. And then we find out gradually how it came to this. The Jonah Hex comics. Jonah Hex, I read back when in the 70s, I believe, is when it first came out. And I loved the stuff. I said, man, if I ever wrote comics, that's who I'd like to write. So one day they called me up years later and said, would you like to write Jonah Hex? We thought you'd be perfect for it. And I said, yes, sir. And so I got with Tim Truman, who is a favorite artist of mine, and he'd wanted to work with me, and I'd wanted to work with him. So we did Two Gun Mojo, that five-part series, which is now released in a bound copy. All of them are, what do you call it, a compilation called Two Gun Mojo, of course. And then I'm doing five more of those called Riders of the Worm and such.
You also have anthologies as editor, Best of the West and New Frontiers. Mm-hmm. These are Western short stories?
Yeah, some of them are very strange Western short stories. But some of them have fantasy elements, science fiction elements, horror elements. Some of them are traditional Westerns. Some of them are modern Westerns. I'm very proud of those. I did three of them. Actually, Razored Saddles is a very strange collection of Western-inspired stories.
So the West, do you think it's making a comeback, perhaps?
I think that a lot of the reason that it hasn't made a comeback is just that the people in New York who do the publishing have decided they're not interested in it. If you live in Texas or you live in the South, you go to a used bookstore, all of the Westerns are tattered from people buying them. But I think that the Western, perhaps with a certain mutation, is making a comeback. And I think that Western's not the classic shoot 'em up and, you know, the school marm sort of thing, like, say, Lonesome Dove, Streets of Laredo. Yeah, I think it's making a comeback. As to whether it's going to be a boom or not, that's a different thing.
Well, your Westerns, as you say, seem to involve a lot of fantasy elements.
Yeah. Well, there goes that influence again, you know, all of it coming together. I'm currently working off and on a Western that doesn't involve fantasy elements. It's just a a big, I don't know, I don't like the word epic, but it's big, you know, and I'll probably, I don't know if I'm going to finish it or not. I'll know in another year whether it's worth doing.
Your agent expressed any interest in this? It would
yes,
seem, really.
My agent was very excited about any of it. Matter of fact, my agent's pretty terrific. He encourages me to do exactly what I want to do, and I find I do better that way. Anytime I try to figure out what's popular or what I like that, that's a mistake, at least for me. I think that there was a time when they pushed me to get in a certain genre, and had I done that, I would be extinct by now. Because, say, I had chosen, I started out science fiction, and I never really made it there. I was a pretty miserable science fiction writer. I wrote a few things. But horror, I was pretty successful. But had I given my all to just being a horror writer or embracing a splatterpunk label or whatever, I would be out of business.
Why do you think you'd be out of business now?
I'd be out of business, I think, because horror as a field is pretty much out of business. And if you become identified too much as a horror writer, a mystery writer, a science fiction writer, I always think that that's difficult. I think in some ways it helps a publisher to promote you. But if there's ever a change in the wind, you can be in trouble. But if you try to promote yourself as Joe R. Lansdale or whoever you are, and people go to it to read your book, not necessarily the next science fiction, the next mystery, then I think that you're ahead of the game.
Dick Lupoff.
When you write comics, now, particularly you mentioned Jonah Hex
yeah.
and Lone Ranger, these are both well-established characters. Jonah Hex has been around for, what,
right.
20, 25 years?
Yeah, a while.
And Lone Ranger for more like 60, I would guess.
60.
How do you feel taking over existing characters and a pre-created mythos rather
yeah.
than creating Joe Lansdale's own
yeah.
universe?
I had the same thing with Batman. You know, I've worked with Batman, too.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, I did Captured by the Engines as a Batman novel. One of the strangest Batman novels that you'll read, that's for sure. But I felt the same way with all of them, is a lot of respect. I didn't start out to say, boy, I'm going to see what I can do to change or mess these up. I didn't feel that way at all. When I started out with Jonah Hex, my Jonah Hex is very much in the vein of the other of the old, of the original Jonah Hex. I think the difference is that you can't help but bring certain elements of your personality to it. I believe in the comics he was a Virginian or a Southerner of some unidentified state, perhaps. And I made him a Texan. I never really said that, but I made him a Texan because I understand Texans. I understand East Texans especially. So that, I think, seeps into it. But I think he's pretty close to the original creation. When I did the Lone Ranger, I went out and I watched all of the Clayton Moore and Jay Silverhill's things, because I had seen those as a kid and I loved them. I was a great fan of the Lone Ranger. And I looked at those and I said, you know, these are fun, but it's the concept of the characters that makes it, because the stories really stink. You know, there's not much happening here. And also, the Lone Ranger is really so goody-two-shoes and so always right that Tonto's always in this sort of as servant role. And so what I did is I watched all of these things and I put it aside and I just let it rest for a while. And I finally came to the conclusion that, like all famous Western heroes, the dime novels had misinterpreted who these characters were, like Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Hickok. And I figured the Lone Ranger, there must have been dime novels about him. And so I figured that they were inaccurate. And you get the true story with my comics. And yet it's true to the tradition and the honor and the respect of the Lone Ranger. But I think it's giving a little bit more human insight, a little bit more humor.
I keep remembering that old joke about the Lone Ranger, where the Lone Ranger is surrounded and he goes, "Hey, Kemosabe." And Tonto goes, "What? What are you talking about?"
Yeah, what do you mean? What do you mean, we white man?
Right.
But that's there. There, the elements is there. But we didn't want to make it that easy. As like, you know, the Lone Ranger and Tonto get up one day and have an argument, and they break up, or suddenly they decide that it wasn't that simple. We had a lot of little complex things going through the four issues, and yet I think the issues themselves are a hoot. They're a throwback to just, you know, pure wild fun. And Edgar Rice Burroughs probably has a little bit of a finger in this pie, too.
Well, you must have read his westerns. He did a few.
Oh, I read. Yes, I did.
The movie The Lone Ranger, though, was an absolute disaster.
Oh, awful. Dreadful.
Have you had any contact with Hollywood yourself?
Oh, yeah. I've had several books. John Badham threw a guy optioned Savage Season, and he did a screenplay, and John Badham picked it up for 3 years. John Irvin's had Cold in July for about 5 years. Dead in the West, which is my zombie Western, has been optioned now about 7 years running. and several short stories have been optioned. You know, I continue to cash the checks. I've written and been hired to write a couple of the screenplays, and I wrote those. I wrote Dead in the West and Cold in July screenplay. None of these things have materialized into films. Perhaps they will, perhaps they won't, you know, but I'm sure, well, actually, I feel like I'll get into film eventually. It's one of those things I'm interested in, but I'm a novelist and a short story writer first. All the other things, comics, film, peripheral.
The Drive-In, two novels. Can you talk about those? Because they seem to have a reputation all their
own.
Yeah,
they kind of have a little cult following. They are certainly strange novels. The Drive-In, what I did is I took my own drive-in experiences growing up in East Texas and going to the drive-in, everybody piling in the back or in the trunk to go to see the all-night horror fest. And usually these were really low-budget movies. I mean, they weren't, you know, high-scale stuff. A lot of that stuff I've never seen again. It came to the drive-in and left. And, you know, it wasn't any good the first time, so maybe that's part of it. But in the book, a bunch of friends go to the drive-in, and the culture in the drive-in in Texas used to be, two people come there for barbecues and have a big time and run around, and they had swing sets for the children, and it was a real party sort of community atmosphere almost. So in the book, they go to the drive-in, and as the movies are going along, a giant comet comes down out of the sky and smiles and just shows like it has teeth. And when it swoops up and away and it's gone, the drive-in is surrounded by total blackness. It's like being encased in giant chocolate pudding. Only thing is, it's acidic and nobody can get out. And the culture in the drive-in begins to disintegrate. And we also have two characters in the book who become fused together by a strange electrical lightning that creates a character called the Popcorn King, which becomes representative of a lot of evils in the world. And I think it's pretty funny, pretty nasty, and I hope satirical at the same time. I certainly thought of it as writing a satire.
Working in all of these different forms, short story, novel, comics, screenplay, and whatnot, do you find that they're significantly different?
No. They're different, but significantly different. No, writing's writing for me. I know some people don't feel that way. Be honest, I have more respect for prose, I have more respect for novels and short stories than I do the screenplay, for example. But in one way, you either know how to write or you don't.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of your current novel, Mucho Mojo, mm-hmm. where the press kit, which your publisher so kindly furnished to us, gives reproductions of a couple of very influential reviews, one from the Kirkus Review Service, mm-hmm. not too widely known to the public, but mm-hmm. very influential in the trade, which just absolutely loves the book, and one that looks to me, let's see, yes, this is Publishers Weekly, that does not mm-hmm. particularly care mm-hmm. for it, and accused you specifically of, I think their term was, this is an air-popped short story,
yeah.
Speaking of graphic imagery. Mm-hmm. Did you send them something nasty in the mail? Did you
no, I think reviews.
How did you feel about
it? I felt it was a very honest review. I felt that's what the person thought. Mm-hmm. It didn't come across like it was a personal attack. The idea that you could be universally admired is idiotic. And the idea that if you believe the bad ones, you know, that, and that's what you think, then it's like the whole deal. I think Hemingway said, if you believe the good reviews, you got to believe the bad reviews. So, I mean, the book list just gave me a rave. And then another one, I get all kinds of these of nice raves. And if I believe them all the time and say, well, this one bad one, this has got to be the wrong one.
Well,
that's
true. Isn't that true?
Well, you have to let the readers decide. The thing is I made my decision when I wrote the book. And I look at reviews as tools. I use the good ones as tools. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're any more correct than the others. I like to think they're correct. But a lot of times, some of the most idiotic reviews I've ever gotten were the good ones. I didn't think they understood it at all. I've gotten some bad reviews where I thought they actually understood the book, although I like to think the book was better than the review gave it.
You ever push somebody's button so they're absolutely raging, hysterical, frothing at the mouth with hatred for you, and in a strange way you feel good about
it? Yeah,
that?
I've done that a few times.
Yeah, I that's think one of my guilty pleasures.
Yeah, I've done that in some of the books sometimes. Some of the books have offended people, or I've stepped on sacred cows on religion or whatever. Yeah.
Richard Wilinski.
That review that you mentioned from Publishers Weekly, pretty much saying that Mucho Mojo is an expanded short story. In many ways, I like the book, but yet I agree with that in the sense that you're always willing to go off on a tangent that really has nothing to do with the plot.
Yeah.
I was once told a long time ago, stick to the plot of the character and never...
That was the advice I got early on, too. I think you can't break the rules till you know them. And I think that if you start out doing that, it doesn't work. Now, everybody has to decide for themselves. For me, the books that I like are the books that aren't afraid to do that for the simple reason is this. I see, I'm not really sure that you're getting away from the story if you're letting people know who the characters are. And if you know a little bit about their life and you make them aware that they have a life outside of just the story that's going on, I think it smacks a little closer to reality. And I think it's a little more believable.
So you see nothing wrong. For instance, Anne Rice's Tale of the Body Snatcher, she spends, I don't know, 50, 75 pages, I think Tale of the Body Thief.
A mere bagatelle for Anne Rice.
Right. 50 to 75 pages having vampires talk about whether they believe in God. Mm-hmm. Just out of the blue, completely separate from the novel as a whole. You see no problem with doing that then.
Well, I don't know about that book. I haven't read it, so I can't say. I think sometimes it's wrong. And sometimes I don't have a hard and fast rule, because then if I embrace that rule, I have to embrace it for everybody that's ever done that didn't work. I feel like what I was trying to do, I felt, was make it work by making you know that these characters had a life outside of this crime. I wasn't as interested in the mystery in the sense there's a mystery there, but I always felt that the reader ought to at least be ahead of me on this, ought to be ahead of the characters. Because the characters are, it's really not so much who did it, but how they put it all together and what they do about it. And I was more interested in that. That doesn't mean that next time I might feel more inclined to be a little bit more plot-oriented. I've done that before, but I tend to be more interested in the characters. I think as long as what you tell about the characters is entertaining and it's interesting and it's informative and it's insightful, that it's pretty much okay. I won't say solidly, completely okay, because you got to have a storyline. It's got to be there. It's got to be something that pulls the reader. You've got to have a sense of, I want to turn the next page. Not necessarily in a thriller, flip the page sort of way, but a desire to know what these characters are going to do.
Well, in fact, there's been some discussion over this in the mystery field in particular in recent years, whether the characters should have an offstage life, whether they should have hobbies and believe in God or not believe in God, or have a family life, or have a cat at home.
Yeah,
well, they have cats at home. I don't know why. Or you know, or any of the 100 or 1,000. What's your favorite flavor of ice cream? What's your favorite kind? Mm-hmm. You know, what tune do you whistle when you walk down the street whistling a tune and so forth? Should the characters have all of the 1,001 peculiar quirks that make a whole person? Or should the detective be just the detective? Should the criminal be just the criminal?
I think both ways work. It depends on what you're after. There are some people that read entirely for the mystery. And they're in a sense, I think they're the same sort of people who like crossword puzzles and they're looking for a puzzle. And I think that's fine. It's just, I guess, on the chance of sounding highfalutin, I come at it from a more literary angle, meaning that not necessarily highfalutin literary, you know, concepts, but the sense that for me, what reading fiction is about is finding something about the human experience and that I believe and finding some insight into the characters and trying to believe in the characters, trying to have some sort of voice and some sort of style that's entertaining and yet seems to illuminate the human condition, you know, and I say that with all modesty because I don't want that to sound like I think I'm John Updike. I'm just saying that for me, the whole idea of a mystery, just laying that out, this doesn't do much for me. That doesn't mean I'm opposed to that or that I don't read that occasionally, or I might not even write that. You know, that may happen. I may decide I want to do a puzzle mystery, but it's unlikely.
Would you say that that's the equivalent of the hard science wiring diagrams we used to call it in science fiction?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. The hard-boiled school and the gold medal school were a greater influence on me than the Agatha Christie school, for example. Mm-hmm. I enjoy a film made like the Agatha Christie books better than I enjoy the books because I'm not interested in those characters. I'm not interested in that prose. But I can enjoy a film of that sort a lot easier. With the other sort, the kind that I think I'm doing, which I think somewhat out of gold medal, out of Dashiell Hammett, Hemingway, gold medal, etc., I can like both books and films and whatever. That whole genre interests me if it's done well.
Mucho Mojo, being the second of at least three stories, the characters become more than just characters in a book. They develop their own backstory that continues mm-hmm. over the course, almost a mm-hmm. soap opera. How mm-hmm. do you feel about that?
I must feel pretty good about it. I'm doing it. The thing is, I think there's a point when you can write and it becomes all soap opera. I think that's the other extreme. And I don't want that to happen. I want there to be, you know, I'm trying to write books that, like I said, have some insight, have some literary qualities, but I'm never losing sight of the fact that I read these kind of books for the entertainment, for the elements that come from crime, suspense, and mystery. I want to keep that all there, so that what I put together, getting back to the use of the term gumbo, is a Lansdale gumbo, that people read these and say, hey, you know, this is not what I expected, this is not what I normally read, but yeah, this is entertaining. I like these guys.
We were talking about Tyler, Texas right. before. I've never been there. Were you familiar with the discovery of a warehouse full of old films there some years ago?
No.
Were not. Well, and this should get snipped out of the tape, but we can talk about this off right. the air. I think it's going to fascinate.
I want to hear it, yeah.
Okay.
That's the rose capital of the world. I used to work in the rose fields there.
You worked in the rose fields, and yeah. of course, Hap Collins works in the rose fields at the beginning
yeah.
of Mucho.
Hap Collins Burton. Has a lot of my old body jobs, bodyguard. Bouncer, rose fields, you know, sweet potatoes, and all that stuff.
But what about working in the rose fields? It sounds like a horrible way to earn. I mean,
we think
roses have the best image in the world,
yeah.
right?
Unless you're putting out sticks, which is planting them, putting out budwood on the, you know, hot summer, walking along with your back
stoop bent. Labor.
Yeah, for acres, boom, boom, boom. No, that's no fun.
And what's it pay?
Oh, I don't remember, but I think we probably got a big $2.65 an hour or something back then. They're probably all the way up to $4 now.
Yeah. Well, no wonder Hap Collins wanted to get that.
Yeah, $4 and $5. That's kind of work I did for years.
Joe Lansdale, you have Mucho Mojo now. Next year you have
The Two Bear Mambo, plus they're reprinting my backlist of a crime novel, Savvy Season, Cold in July, and Mucho Mojo will be in paper.
You have any other projects in completely different areas?
Yeah. Like I said, we have the comics that are coming out. I'm currently co-editing with Richard Claw a large comic book anthology. It's about finished, called Weird Business, that will contain a lot of stories, but some of them crime, some of them science fiction, some of them are speculative fiction, mystery, and whatever. And there will be we're also doing some reprints, like Robert Bloch's Hellbound Train has been adapted by Neil Barrett Jr., one of my favorite writers. And we have a variety of very good artists, and it should be a big hardback book coming out of a press in Austin called Mojo Press. I have a short story collection coming out, or it should be out, called Writer of the Purple Rage. And not writer, but writer of the Purple Rage. And then I'll have out Private Eye Action As You Like It, which is my old Private Eye stuff I wrote for Mike Shane Mystery Magazine. Some of it with Lou Shiner, and then we'll add some original story. I mean, some of Lou Shiner's old stories, too.
Joe Lansdale's career has taken off since 1994. As noted at the beginning of the interview, there are over 24 books featuring Hap and Leonard, along with the series that ran on AMC+. He's also credited with episodes of Love, Death, and Robots, and an episode of Creepshow, plus several short films, and a recent Tubi original film titled The Thicket. And you've been listening to an interview with Joe R. Lansdale, recorded August 2nd, 1994, as part of the Probabilities radio series while he was on tour for his Hap and Leonard novel, Mucho Mojo. My co-host was the late Richard A. Lupoff. A new interview with Joe R. Lansdale is currently in the works. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky radio shows on Facebook.